Hi, this is Paul Ingram of PainScience.com. This is the PainSci Updates Podcast, a private, members-only podcast of audio versions of my longer blog posts. Quite a lot longer in this case, though still relatively short by podcasting standards. And by audio versions, I mean I just read my blog posts to you like an audiobook. But I'm good at that. I make it pretty entertaining. It's also a very casual podcast, although I have done professional audio production work in my career a long time ago now, but I did some back in the early 2000s. I do as little of that as possible here for this project. I also mostly don't re-record my bloopers. Super tempting, but I try to stay away from it, and instead I just soldier on like it's a conversation, which gets amusing sometimes. I prefer this minimalistic audio production style not because it makes a better podcast, but because it's fine, and more polished audio is insanely time-consuming to produce, so I'd rather invest that time in more writing and research. Today I have a story for you from my own experience with a particularly strange and nasty mouth pain, and its surprisingly obvious explanation. And the easy solution. Strange, nasty pains aren't normally so tractable. I will begin the story for all readers, but the reveal is for members only, which is you, of course, because you're listening to the audio version, which only goes out to members. A few of you may already remember this story, because this post is partially a rerun. It's an upgrade of the very first members-only post I ever did back in 2021, but most members haven't seen the original, and no one at all has seen it like this, because this version adds much more interpretation and discussion of a certain room elephant that I neglected in the original version. I always wanted to return to this post to try to make more sense of my experience. You've also never heard the post like this, because there is now this audio version. On a personal note, little personal aside, posting has been a bit thin lately due to a family emergency. 3 weeks ago, my wife slipped on the ice. We had a couple of weeks of icy conditions here in Vancouver. We usually get one patch of that each year in this city, maybe two patches of it. It was particularly icy this time. And my wife slipped and injured her back quite badly, and unfortunately not for the first time. Injuries multiplied. She was in a nasty accident in Asia in 2010, which crushed a vertebra, among other things. Although she recovered surprisingly well from that dramatic incident, which is a case study in resilience, she has also had escalating pain and scoliosis ever since, which is a case study in the long-term consequences of injury. Unfortunately, she fell more or less right on that old fracture, and the pain was big. Rehab is going poorly so far. Many struggles. Our sleep has been particularly severely disrupted. I told this story in a little more detail on Facebook this morning if you want to go learn a little bit more about what happened and the background. Hopefully things will soon be getting back to normal at the Salamander's World Headquarters. Thank you for your patience, PainSci members, with the slow posts lately. This is exactly when your patronage really counts. So the setup for my story today is ominous, maybe COVID throat soreness. My wife and I were binging the last season of the show Vikings, which was a good show in many ways, but now, unfortunately, all tangled up with pandemic memories. This was the spring of 2021, peak pandemic, so naturally that throat weirdness made me worry that I might be getting my first case of COVID. I had just been vaccinated a few weeks earlier, but even then I knew to expect breakthrough cases. That was a terrible term. The vaccines were always built to blunt the symptoms, not to stop infection. That's a distinction that never really got through to most people. I also knew that the protection of vaccination was strong but not perfect, and the threat of COVID has always been significantly greater than influenza, even for the fully vaccinated. It's an intimidating infection, even when it doesn't maim and kill. For instance, my wife who's getting a lot of airtime in this post, I notice, had a case of COVID 2 years later in 2023, which caused a hair trigger cough that's never gone away, still a thing in early 2025. It's not full-blown long COVID, but it is some kind of lasting damage. She may have a COVID-caused cough for the rest of her life, and also a vulnerability to all future respiratory tract infections. That's not minor. And even in 2021, it was clear that COVID was dangerous, even for the vaccinated. I was even more suspicious of COVID because I had been in a crowded restaurant for the first time since pre-pandemic, just a couple of days before, just enough time for incubation. Although, interestingly, incubation can be much slower. Viral incubation periods can be shockingly long. According to Lauer et al., the mean for COVID is 5 days, and almost everyone shows symptoms within 10 days. But the longest confirmed incubation period for COVID is 14 friggin' days. Now, how many times in the last few years someone has told me that they can't possibly have COVID or be at risk for it because, quote, it's been more than a week since I was exposed to it? Well, you're not safe. And I have to decide then whether or not to be that guy and crush their naive optimism with facts, which is rarely worth it. So I went to bed with the COVID fear clinging to me like a stink. But the COVID fear did not last the night. The symptom grew and changed fast, like a xenomorph. And now I'm going to do a whole aside about xenomorphs, which is very silly. It's a really good analogy if you know what a xenomorph is. And this is also another note about incubation periods. Xenomorph is the formal term for the alien monster in the Alien franchise of movies, which has always been sloppy with the details of how quickly the alien monster develops. In the original 1979 classic, the alien incubates for at least a couple of days in John Hurt's chest before the famous dinner scene when it bursts through his ribs. And then the weasel-sized larva grows into a huge adult over another few days. It's fast, but maybe possible for exotic biology. But in the more recent films, alien development is accelerated to the point of physics-defying nonsense. For instance, in 2024's Alien Romulus, the foot-long baby alien grows into a 10-foot monster faster than you can boil an egg. It's just silly. So that's what I mean when I say that my symptom grew and changed like a xenomorph, a fast, radical transformation, almost unbelievably fast. Soon after my head hit the pillow, it started to become more of a sore mouth than throat, dominating the right side of my soft palate. And that didn't seem much like any cold or flu I'd ever had. Every time I started to drift off, painful swallowing jolted me awake. I took some ibuprofen at 1 a.m., which did nothing. By 3 a.m., the pain had spread to my teeth, jaw, and cheek on that side, and the fear of COVID was replaced by a fear of what? A jaw infection? Soft palate cancer? I was in that dark place where so many chronic pains have begun, thinking, what could possibly cause that pain? My own chronic pain story, because I am a chronic pain patient, which started in 2015, years after I had already been writing about chronic pain, I have experienced a kaleidoscopic variety of aches and pains, so much so that the variety is like a symptom unto itself. So I'm used to disconcerting sensations, and I was already well used to them by 2021. But this was one of the worst on record, fast, fierce, and bizarre. So by morning, I was an exhausted and nervous wreck. My soft palate felt like it had been punched. The whole right side of my face throbbed, and I couldn't move my jaw properly. I was freaked out, and as the sun rose, it was time, finally, to take a peek into my pie hole. What was going on in there? I might have saved my night if I'd looked sooner. When I finally got a flashlight and took a look, I was quite startled by what I found in my mouth. The problem couldn't have been more obvious if there had been a little devil with a pitchfork in there. There was a blatant, unmistakable, holy crap, look at that, well, there's your problem sign, objective evidence of what was wrong. And yet nothing was bleeding or inflamed. There was no foreign object, but it was still obvious. And it was a sign that suggested an easy fix, which actually worked. The pain was gone less than a minute later, and it did not come back. So that is where I cut off non-members in the post today. A real cliffhanger. But members, that's you, get to find out right now. So what on earth did I see in my dang mouth? I saw my right medial pterygoid muscle. It was standing out in sharp relief. The medial pterygoid is much like the masseter muscle, but smaller and on the inside of the temporomandibular joint instead of the outside. You can see where it normally is under the mucosa behind the molars, but you can't normally see the muscle itself bulging dramatically. Mine was impossible not to see. The hard cord standing well out from the normal contours of the area, as obvious as flexed biceps. It looked thoroughly different from the other side, which was an easy comparison, being only 3 centimeters away. It looked obviously contracted. It was cramping, and presumably it had been cramping like that all night. Cramping is an all too familiar problem for me, one of my many symptoms, which made me even more confident about what I was seeing, but I think that this would have looked like a cramp to anyone who can point to the pterygoid. My first thought was, is it a cause or a symptom? Maybe it was just cramping as a reaction to something else. Seeing the state it was in was certainly surprising and intriguing, but not instantly reassuring. Such problems usually can't be resolved in a minute, which is why what happened next was even more surprising. I reached in with an index finger, and I gave my pterygoid a gentle poke. It felt like a taut rubber band, but painful. That slight pressure made my soft palate light up with the same pain that had been driving me nuts all night. The pain also spread, less dramatically, to the teeth, jaw, and cheek. Interestingly, I had never once been conscious of pain at the location of the muscle itself. I had only felt the referred pain. Let's talk about referred pain briefly. The brain is somewhat inept at precisely locating internal pain, and so sometimes we experience pain in a broad area around or near the cause or even further afield. This is the very same phenomenon as heart attack pain felt mainly in the arm. The brain just can't figure out where the pain is coming from, and the arm pain is a bad guess. Patterns of referral from the musculoskeletal system are somewhat predictable, and most referred pain spreads away from the center and the head, laterally and distally. By contrast, visceral referral is much more erratic, and for sites in the head, kind of seems like all bets are off. Who knows where you're going to get referral from just about anything in the head. So I rubbed my pterygoid, the poor thing, cautiously for about 30 seconds, and I must have magic hands because that gave me immediate and great relief, as obviously helpful as stretching out a cramping calf muscle. It visibly softened as I worked, fading into the mucosa like Homer Simpson backing into the hedge. That's a famous clip from The Simpsons. If you want to do a search for that, it's worth a look. It's cute. And it really feels apt. That image of Homer sinking into the hedge really looks exactly like my pterygoid did, just kind of slowly fading away. The cramp was gone. The pain was gone. And they did not come back. That was simply the end of the ordeal, like I flipped a switch. So here are some initial reactions to this odd experience. I've got 4 relatively brief points, and then the rest of the post is about a fifth. First, how common are less severe and obvious examples of this kind of thing? How often do we suffer from strange aches and pains that are just some damn little muscle cramping, but we just can't see it or reach it? More generally, how many pains have relatively simple but invisible causes, making them seem much more mysterious than they actually are? I'm asking these as questions because I don't know, but I'm also asking them because I strongly suspect that this is extremely common. Point two, the proximate cause of this pain appeared to be badly behaved muscle tissue. It is unclear why the muscle was in that state. There could be any number of deeper explanations, some of them quite ominous, like a neuropathy, but the tissue that actually hurt certainly seemed to be muscle. And muscle can certainly be a source of pain, although that is an oddly controversial point. Point number two here is brief, but it's got a longish footnote, which is worth digging into. Regarding pain being something that can come from muscle, I've got a very interesting citation from 2004, which I will describe to you. It's an interesting and relevant aside. This study attempted to determine if painful and non-painful pressure sensations from muscles actually exist. That might seem like an odd research question to ask. But it is possible that much of what seems like deep muscle sensation could in fact come from an illusion of depth inferred from pressure on the skin, like a 3D image projected on a flat screen. Sensation and perception are full of oddities like this, so we can't actually take it for granted that muscle itself is sensitive. The authors put it this way, quote, painful and non-painful pressure sensations from muscle are generally accepted to exist, but the peripheral neural correlate has not been clarified. So this is a challenging question to study because it's difficult to eliminate skin sensation as a part of the equation. So these researchers went to rather a lot of trouble to do just that with, quote, anesthetized skin combined with a block of large diameter muscle afferents. So anesthetized skin and nerves supplying sensation to muscle. And it turns out that people can still feel pressure and pain even with numb skin. This isn't conclusive in itself, but this evidence does very strongly suggest that muscle tissue proper knows when it's being poked, and therefore very likely can also be sensitive to being poked, like my pterygoid muscle. Point number three, reaction number three to my odd experience. The cramp was clearly not a response to any continuing significant provocation, or it would have come back. It was self-sustaining. Regardless of what got it going in the first place, it had become its own clinically significant phenomenon, capable of continuing to cause trouble all by itself. Like the Ship of Theseus paradox, the pain was both the old problem and a new one. Reaction number four, this story is a win for massage. There was so little massage, it barely qualifies. It was so effective that it almost seemed like cheating. But I think massage still deserves the credit. What put a stop to the pain was definitely applying pressure to soft tissue. Brief but powerful. I've been brewing a less is more point about massage for quite a while now. I strongly suspect that surprisingly small doses of massage can be helpful. And this is a great example. And now let's move on to the trickiest reaction to this experience, that elephant in the room. And this is what I didn't go into when I first told this story back in 2021. Trigger points have entered the chat. I don't know if this is a story about a trigger point or not, and I mean that. I truly do not know. And maybe I shouldn't even care, but the resemblance is so obvious that it would be weird not to talk about it. Experienced listeners can skip ahead about a minute here. I'm going to do a quick review of what trigger points are. They are the common name given to unexplained sore spots in muscle. And it's a controversial idea. No one doubts that people do have weird sore spots that need explaining, but the explanations and the solutions are hotly debated. Skeptics don't think that they are a thing, not a palpable or treatable lesion in muscle tissue. And I have on painscience.com approximately 1,000 times more information about this topic than I'm doing here. the conventional wisdom about trigger points is that they are micro cramps, which is an awful lot like what I saw. More specifically, my terrible pterygoid might have been a fine example of the infamous top band that is reputed to house many trigger points. Also, the decisive relief from a little rubbing harmonizes nicely with a widely held belief that fresh trigger points are easier to ease. So, my anecdote sure sounds like a trigger point anecdote. Or maybe that is all nonsense. Maybe this was clearly more of a macro cramp, the whole muscle, not just the taut band. And maybe the treatment wasn't a trigger point release, but just gentle stretch of a spasm, no more exotic than stretching out your foot arch when it cramps in the night. Is there a need to speak of trigger points other than noting the resemblance? Maybe not. Many would argue that anecdotes are all that trigger points have ever had, and most of them are extremely unreliable. But not all anecdotes are created equal, and most people telling stories about trigger points aren't particularly skeptical about them. But I am. Skeptics are supposed to sneer at all anecdotal evidence or anecdata equally, even though there is obviously a great range of quality and value in anecdotes. There's a world of difference between some brainwashed grifter telling stories about the supplement their pyramid scheme is built on versus a self-aware expert thoughtfully reporting their experience and exploring different possible interpretations, including no idea. So, I'm telling a trigger point anecdote, but I am a skeptic about trigger points. I've had my own strong doubts about trigger point therapy since near the end of my career in massage therapy in 2010. And here's another little detour for newer listeners. If you know me, you can skip the next minute or two here. If you're new here, you might want to listen. I was a registered massage therapist with a busy practice in Vancouver, Canada from 2000 to 2010. I quit the profession in disgust before I could be fired, quote unquote, for being critical of pseudoscience and alternative medicine. I changed my professional focus to science journalism and anti-quackery activism, writing mostly about massage-adjacent topics in the early years, but then spreading out into anything relevant to any kind of chronic pain or injury rehab, which is an effectively infinite list of topics. The profession of massage therapy, which I am qualified to comment on, is, alas, rotten with myths and bullshit. Now, if that statement gets your back up, and it might, because I've got a whole bunch of new massage therapist subscribers lately, or if it just paralyzes you with professional angst because you agree with it, please, please, I beg you, read this short article on my website, on painscience.com. It is titled Reassurance for Massage Therapists: How Ethical, Progressive, Science-Respecting Massage Therapists Can Thrive in a Profession Badly Polluted with Nonsense. So I am on the record with my doubts about my own anecdotes, about my own treatment success stories. But even more notably, I have doubted and discounted and dismissed one of the very best of them, a very old story that is amazingly similar to my tale of pterygoid terrorism. It took place anatomically next door in the masseter muscle. It's so similar to this much fresher anecdote that I think it's time to tell it now. So let me take you much further back in time, all the way to 1997, in my first year of massage therapy training. Cue flashback harp. So in 1997, my tooth had been throbbing for days, and I had a dentist appointment the next day, where I expected a diagnosis of rotting tooth. But first, by sheer chance, I had a massage therapy appointment first, and my massage therapist fixed my toothache completely by rubbing my jaw muscle in about 5 minutes. I canceled my dental appointment, and that tooth never ached again. Wow, right? Well, that experience was my original inspiration for embracing trigger point therapy early in my career, and that therapist was a mentor to me for a few years. But then uh-oh, I slowly became a hardened skeptic, keen to question my own reality, and I began to doubt my own best anecdote. It couldn't possibly have been as miraculous as it seemed at the time. Maybe I missed an alternative explanation that I wouldn't miss these days, or maybe it was just a fluke. And so that 1997 anecdote, which was once one of the pillars of my career, eventually faded into a dubious legend that I didn't take seriously, even though it was my very own story. The credibility of my old mouth pain story seems partially restored by my much fresher one. It might have really meant what it seemed to mean to me originally. Many years into my identity as a curmudgeonly skeptic, my mind is armed with a full suite of critical analysis tools that I didn't even know existed in 1997. Thinking critically is truly a skill that takes time to learn, but none of those tools and skills seem to be helpful here. Nothing I have ever used to explain these experiences to myself is particularly implausible or absurd, certainly not compared to the worst ideas in this business. There are many examples of ideas that are much more implausible, but I'll highlight the most blatantly obvious one. Acupuncture points are way more implausible than trigger points. Acupuncture points and meridians are quite literally magical, requiring a childish pseudo-religious faith and a life force unknown to physics. They certainly have a superficial resemblance to trigger points, nestled inside their taut bands, just like acupuncture points are embedded in meridians, but the resemblance ends there. The idea of a trigger point is a microcramp or any other kind of lesion, even if it's dead wrong, is at least a coherent and testable hypothesis about physiology and pathology. In terms of scientific plausibility, they aren't even in the same league. I can't just dismiss what happened as a coincidence. It was too sudden and dramatic in both cases. You can't regress to the mean in the 30 seconds it takes to rub an obviously spasming muscle. There were no non-specific effects of the therapeutic encounter to blame it on, no relevant contextual effects. There may well have been some therapy theater in the 1997 experience, but probably not in 2021, and yet they both had the same outcome. And let's veer over to the side here to talk about contextual effects and therapy theater. Contextual effects are the effects of the context in which treatment happens, the messy halo of variables that surround and influence it. Coincidentally, this is the subject of my last small blog post, actually. Therapy theater is therapy that is optimized for contextual effects with an emotionally engaging narrative about what's actually going on. The most pure examples of therapy theater are faith healing and healing rituals in a folk medicine context. The theatrics are not generally deceptive or misleading, but well-intentioned exaggerations of partial truths. In manual therapy, sensory input is often a critical part of the show, using strong and novel sensations to demonstrate the power of the treatment. In the context of trigger point therapy, the seed of truth is that pressure on specific spots certainly can cause strong and interesting sensations, but it gets theatrical when therapists start to explain those sensations. The theatrical version tells a story of wisdom in finding the spot, its clinical significance, and the power in being able to manipulate it, most of which is speculative at best, and some of it is often just self-aggrandizing garbage. Like, I've seen people recover from an ulcer after treating a trigger point like this, just saying. A non-theatrical version of trigger point therapy would be nothing at all. It would tell no story at all, no magic hands to be amazed by. So to rewind slightly, now that we've defined the terms here, I don't think that it's likely that contextual effects or therapy theater were involved. Perhaps I benefited from an optimism-powered placebo. The sight of that cramping muscle made me miserable and alarmed, not reassured and optimistic, and I didn't feel happier for at least an hour because I thought it was all too likely to come back. I was only retroactively confident about it. So it's not a coincidence that I decided to rerun this post in early 2025. Every once in a while, the topic of trigger points blows up on social media again, and it did in late February 2025, triggered by a new paper by Chad Cook et al. Titled Myofascial Pain Syndromes, Controversies and Suggestions for Improving Diagnosis and Treatment. The paper takes the idea of myofascial pain syndrome seriously, which annoys skeptics. And myofascial pain syndrome is basically just means too many trigger points. But it also impugns the scientific credibility of trigger points, which upsets the believers. You know, it's a good compromise when no one is happy. And yet, ironically, Cook et al. Took an approach that's similar to my own, that is relatively agnostic, aiming for a balance where both sides are taken seriously. But somehow, I have mostly managed to make everyone happy instead of no one. Skeptics cheerfully cite my work on this topic all the time, assuming that I am on Team Skeptic. But many trigger point therapists also lay claim to my allegiance. The truth is, I am a dirty, rotten fence sitter. So I guess people see what they want to see. I didn't participate in this kerfuffle. I am sick of the low quality of the debate. It is badly polarized. Everyone picked their team years ago, and discussions are dominated by the militant. I see simple rhetorical bloopers getting made ad nauseum by people who should have known better all along. And meanwhile, I have already written down everything I have to say on the topic. Hundreds of thousands of words, no stone unturned, hundreds of footnotes and citations, every detail of the topic examined earnestly. So when this flared up, I had a very, I'm getting too old for this shit, reaction to the debate. Not today, Satan. Maybe another time. Plus, as mentioned earlier, I'm a little distracted. Right now, stretched a bit thin by the personal situation, by my wife's recent fairly severe injury. So I just didn't have the juice for it. Let's try to bring this home. What am I taking away from this experience with my mouth pain? I am not fool enough to think that I know what happened, but my confidence level is fairly high, although I don't know why I had a pterygoid cramp like that. It seems clear that I did. And it obviously behaved much like I think trigger points behave, based on my deep knowledge of the lore and literature. Whether I agree with it or not, I know what people think and believe about trigger points in great detail, and there's no question that this experience looked like a trigger point anecdote. On the other hand, I don't think it's obviously necessary or useful to invoke trigger points. I could just as happily call this a weird little cramp. But that might be a distinction without a difference, since weird little cramp is, after all, basically the main hypothesis for what a trigger point actually is. It has always been clear to me that trigger points, quote-unquote, the words, they're just an overinterpreted label for that clinical phenomenon. I don't much care what we call it. I do care about understanding it, and the trigger point model probably isn't accurate, but it might be useful. In any case, I strongly suspect that various kinds of cramping account for a lot of otherwise unexplained aches and pains. The direct evidence for this broad hypothesis is weak at best, virtually non-existent at worst. But the indirect and partial evidence is extensive, and the plausibility is high, and my pterygoid terrorism was a superb example. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.